Rethinking Early European Literature, next on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Edwin Duval of Yale University is here to talk about satire and structure in early modern French literature. Before that, Catherine O'Brien O'Keefe of the University of Notre Dame discusses new perspectives on Old English literature.
Saturnus quaff, ac hu ye gangeth that, goda o the evle, thona he beoth thur anna, idaza akenda, troian ye twinas, ne bethira tir ye leek, frigi ik thek, hlavard Solomon, huadra bethira folgoth betra.
Literary historian Catherine O'Brien O'Keefe reading from a poem entitled Solomon and Saturn II. She'll be back in just a moment to talk about sources, history, and interpretation in Old English literature. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional funding from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. For most readers, Old English literature begins and ends with Beowulf, the epic poem of mythic battles and monsters. But according to one scholar who recently worked at the National Humanities Center, other, lesser-known works of Old English verse also deserve our attention. Catherine O'Brien O'Keefe teaches at the University of Notre Dame. She's at work on a project that examines sources, history, and interpretation in Old English verse. For instance, she sees one 10th century poem as off-brand, meaning that it furnishes new perspectives for understanding Old English literature. The title of this poem is Solomon and Saturn II. Catherine O'Brien O'Keefe sees it from the viewpoint of traditional philology, but she also holds it up to the prism of modern critical theory. With that in mind, I ask Catherine O'Brien O'Keefe to describe what happens in Solomon and Saturn II.
To say what happens, I'm not sure anything happens. If you're thinking of a narrative where you get somebody right. from point A to point B.
Uh-huh.
What the poem is a conversation. It's a contest. It could even be a fight between two characters, one called Solomon, and that we presume is King Solomon, and the other is his pagan competitor, who's called Saturn. And they are exchanging riddles, really. It's a poem that deals with riddle wisdom. And they're fighting about all sorts of things. And the competition is to determine who at the end is the wisest.
Uh-huh. Is this what we would call philosophy? I mean, it sounds like there's a strong philosophical content to the poem.
I think it's philosophy / theology.
Uh-huh.
It's odd, almost bizarre wisdom. There's folk wisdom in it. There's some proto-science. It's a real mixed bag of stuff. Some of it is incredibly esoteric and learned.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what underscores the writing of this poem. And what I'm leading you to here is the question of your scholarship when we talk of all the various ologies here. One of the ologies is philology. That is to say, figuring out what this poem is about, looking at its language, looking mm-hmm. at it on its own terms. Mm-hmm. And we should tell our listeners that before our taping session, you have informed me that there's something of a tug of war going on between the people who do philology, mm-hmm. looking at poems like this, and the schools of modern criticism mm-hmm. that apply themselves, that fix themselves to this kind of literature.
Mm-hmm.
Again, a big order. Talk to me about this.
This is an incredibly big order. I think each of the older disciplines of literature has found itself a ground of contest over the last several years between those approaches to the discipline which are traditional and those which are newer.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the areas of conflict has been a conflict between what is called old philology and what some people call, but by no means all people call, new philology. Part of the problem is understanding the ways in which we can approach a poem using history, using language, using manuscripts, to try to understand the poem within its own context,
mm-hmm.
but also to understand it with an appreciation of our own historical state in the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not only trying to understand what the poem could possibly have begun to mean in the 9th or the 10th century, but to understand where we are as 20th century people.
You've told me, Catherine, that as people of the 20th century, we walk into a bookstore or we go buy a record or a CD or a tape, and there it is. It's a kind of a thing in front of us that is fixed, and it's a performance. Books, after all, are performances. And in a way, these ancient manuscripts that you look at represent the same thing with many different twists and spins between us and them, right?
When you mention the word performance, you really got my mind going, because I think when you and I walk into a bookstore and we see five copies of Jane Eyre on the shelf, right, and they're all the same edition, they're all, say, Penguin, we know that each of these five copies is identical with the other four. And we make that assumption because we are conditioned by our literacy and by print conventions. You can't make that assumption about the manuscript states of medieval texts, whether prose or poetry. And it's so much more obvious with verse texts. In that case, I would say that if you have a CD, for example, you have a recording of a performance. Each of the manuscripts of a medieval text is itself a performance.
So there is no, what, sort of fixed, received, single standard by which a poem like Solomon and Saturn had its existence. The phrase you use is its mode of being way back there in Old English literature.
See, I think what happens is once writing is introduced into a culture, once literary performance comes to be written down, that writing acts as a very conservative force on the preservation of a text. But this is an historical phenomenon. You have authors, for example, let's take an Old English author named like Alfrich. Alfrich writes in a number of his works, telling the scribe to make sure he copies it correctly. It's very clear that at the time that Alfrich was living around the turn of the millennium, that he wanted his works copied. He felt himself to be an author. He wanted his works copied accurately.
So who is the author here? I mean, that's the question. Well, is it the scribe or is it this man who has, quote, written the work?
Well, when we have a name like Alfrich, it gets very worrying because you clearly have an author. I think it's a lot more interesting when you have a set of anonymous texts, as most Old English verse is anonymous. There, what we do is invent authors. We can talk about the Beowulf poet,
right,
which is a very funny way of getting around the fact that we really feel very uncomfortable with
that.
We don't know who wrote this stuff. But what I'm arguing is that when you have a manuscript which is a performance, it is a performance precisely because as the text we now have went through a process of being handed down, whoever wrote it, composed it, orally written, however you want to look at the situation, whoever composed this is working hand in glove, although he doesn't or she doesn't know it, with the scribe who commits it to parchment.
Now, how does all of this play in our modern notions of literary criticism and theory? I mean, we have had over, I don't know, whatever number you want to fix on it, 10, 20, 50 years, a rise of theoretical pressures on the doing, the writing and the interpreting of literature. You really have quite an odd set of bedfellows here, do you not? You know, the modern theorists and the old-time philologists?
Well, we have to remember that in the 19th century, these, what we call old-time philologists, were radical guys. And they had taken the discipline away from the people they disparagingly called antiquarians. And they had made it, in their view, scientific. They hijacked it.
And now that's happening again?
Well, I suppose if you wanted to look at it in that way, yeah, there's another set of hijackings going on, another set of resistances. And this is, I think, very healthy for the discipline.
Now, how does that bear, for example, on what you're doing with this old English work called Solomon and Saturn? What again, this is a big order, but if you had to tease out one of the interpretive nuts here that you're trying to crack, what would it be? What kind of problems do you face?
Well, one of the things I am facing is looking at this poem through an understanding of Old English verse that is very much determined by epic. That is, our literary understanding of Old English verse is mostly determined by an aesthetic which makes Beowulf the center of Old English poetry.
So we're talking more about form than we are content.
Well, form and content, because epic is narrative, right? This poem is not a narrative poem. Beowulf, many people feel that Beowulf had oral origins if its final state was not composed orally. Solomon Saturn could not have been oral, I do not believe.
Too complicated, too. I mean, it sounds to me like there was too much learned traffic going
on. It's not just too complicated. I think I can demonstrate a number of passages where the source text for this had to have been written and was Latin. And in that case, it's kind of hard to say, well, it had an oral...
what does that tell you about the audience? That is to say, the men and women who consumed this poetry, who used it to various ends.
Right. Well, this is one of the very difficult things. There is so much that we don't know. And one of the things that I'm trying to do with this poem, and, you know, I'm very self-conscious about the fact that this is an off-brand poem, is try to imagine how would we look at Old English literature if Beowulf was not the center of the canon, but this thing was. In that case, we'd
creates new standards.
It creates an entirely new set of expectations. We'd be asking ourselves very different questions.
Does that make you something of a heretic amongst your
colleagues? I hope not. what I'm doing is taking the general normal sets of technical procedures and look using them to look at Solomon and Saturn II, but also, I hope, trying to use some of the more recent theoretical moves and playing with the poem in that way.
You become something of a literary archaeologist, don't you, Catherine? That is to say, looking at, I mean, I take it you deal with the physical documents themselves as well as the interpretive tools that you are bringing to this.
Yeah, one of my good friends has been teasing me about becoming a materialist. I'm very, very interested in looking at the text as it appears on the page, because I think that the text, because it is unique, because it is a performance, provides us with a great deal of information just in its pure manuscript state. It's very hard for us to read this stuff.
Sure. How does it play amongst students? I mean, speaking of audiences, you are a student, a professional student of Old English literature and culture, and you have your students. We are talking about a tiny number of people who really pay attention to this stuff in our modern world, are we not?
Yeah, it's a small number of people.
Does that make you defensive? I mean, how does it fly in the modern world?
It kind of makes me a missionary. This stuff is some of it is kind of ordinary, but some of the stuff that is in Old English is incredibly beautiful.
Well, Catherine, I want to thank you for this overview of your work. Let me tell our listeners about you. You are Catherine O'Brien O'Keefe. You are moving, even as we speak, you're moving from Texas A&M up to the University of Notre Dame. I take it that that's a happy transition for you?
Oh, I'm going to enjoy it a great deal. I'm only moving physically to Notre Dame. This year I have technically been on the faculty at Notre Dame.
Fair enough. And you've also been a fellow of the National Humanities Center. Catherine, thank you so much for coming by to talk on Soundings.
Thank you, Wayne. I've enjoyed it very much.
Well, I wish you well in your work.
Thank you.
This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Structure and design in early modern French literature. Join me now for a conversation with literary historian Edwin Duval of Yale University.
Puis, en grande véhémence d'esprit, déployant ses bras, le tourner, virer, brouiller, barbouiller, hercer, verser, renverser, natter, gratter, flatter, baratter, batter, bouter, buter, trabuster, culbuter, trépé, tremper, taper, timper, étouper, détouper, détraquer, tricoter, tripoter, chapoter.
Literary historian Edwin Duval, reading from the work of François Rabelais. To his modern readers, Rabelais is the late medieval French writer who managed to blend the epic and the body. His works are learned, yet they appeal to popular audiences. But however streetwise in his own time, Rabelais is a writer whose work requires some labor on the part of his readers. Edwin Duval is a professor of French at Yale University. He says that one reason that Rabelais can be difficult for modern readers is an apparent lack of organization. Works like Gargantua and Pantagruel, for example, seem to be only episodic, even formless. To offset that impression, Edwin Duval is writing a multi-volume study of coherence and meaning in François Rabelais, exploring the structure and design of his work. I asked Edwin Duval to explain.
Let me tell you quickly about the books that he wrote. The first two of these, Pantagruel and Gargantua, are mock epics, satirical epics, frequently scatological, popular in tone, about giants. And these giants, each Pantagruel and Gargantua, both giants of successive generations, being prepared by a humanist education for epic exploits in which there are mock Homeric battles and the forces of evil are overcome and a reign of peace and tranquility triumphs. What I do is to approach these books with the presuppositions and the cultural baggage that the original readers automatically would have brought to them.
Now, that's a big order.
It is a big order, and no one can do it.
Getting back into that mindset, right?
But I think we have to try, and with a little effort, we can come pretty close, I think, reading these books as they were meant to be read.
Now that means, Ned, that you have to figure out what it meant in the 15th century to be educated, to have a sense of popular culture, to have a sense of the religion of the time. Where do you begin?
I begin with the footnotes in great positivist editions of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, in which scholars identified sources, what they called sources. They found echoes from various works that were not prepared to perceive primarily. Well, it's easy for someone like me to come along and read everything that's listed in those footnotes and get some idea of what people had read, to get some idea of the presuppositions that they came to these books on the basis of all that.
All right. Now, is it fair to say, Ned, that with enough time and knowledge and reading these footnotes, that it really is possible to achieve a sense of what it was like to live in Rabelais' time? How well, in effect, does the work travel over time?
Yeah. I can't say that I have any idea what it was like to live in those times. Those times were really quite alien to us. But the intellectual framework within which people worked is something that you can get a handle on. You can master to a considerable degree, I think.
Is it fair to say that people were smarter then than they are now? I mean, that there was more floating around of what we would call knowledge in the popular mind than what floats around today. Is that beside the point?
People were not smarter, I suspect, but they had a much more intense literary education, in classical literature primarily, in theology also. We have, if anything, more knowledge, but it's much more dispersed and less coherent.
All right. Now, one of the apparent contradictions or paradoxes, you told me before our taping session, Ned, is that in works by Rabelais, we're talking about Pantagruel and Gargantua, you have a couple of levels operating, high erudition, a lot of very specialized knowledge, but it comes to us in this very body, street sense kind of language. Is that a contradiction?
To our eyes, it certainly is a contradiction. I've come to believe that in the eyes of Rabelais' contemporaries, it was not such a contradiction, because people lived what we now call popular culture every day. The liturgical calendar guaranteed that every single person knew certain popular forms of existence.
And yet it was okay to use scatological language, very body, earthy language that even in our so-called liberated modern mind wouldn't really fly very well on radio or TV, the newspapers.
I wouldn't claim that no one took offense in the 16th century to some of the scatological and misogynistic elements in Rabelais. But I do believe that we are much more sensitive to such things, and we are very intolerant of certain excesses that would have been quite acceptable.
All right, now you just used the word misogyny. How is it that we should understand a writer like Rabelais when we come to him through our modern eyes? Do we label him as a hater of women, as an unfair critic of this or that part of our of the society back then, and dismiss him on those terms?
Well, there are two ways of looking at this question. One is that we have to understand these books in historical context. We can easily judge them and condemn them based on our own sensibilities and our own sense of what is right.
Political correctness.
Yes, and I think we're correct to take offense because we don't want the world to look the way it does in Rabelais' books. Uh-huh. But we have to understand that in the 16th century, women were not equal to men, and no one, and including most women, would ever have challenged that article of faith. Mm. And secondly, in other words, we have to get over our own prejudices, our own sense of what is.
Well, that's one of the things that literature is supposed to do for us, is it
it's,
not?
Well, I believe it is, and I think that we abdicate our responsibility as readers if we judge everything by our own criteria. And the second answer I would give to that is we have to examine very carefully the function of what we think of as misogynistic elements in Rabelais, uh-huh, within the overall design. And there, again, I would come back to this idea of overall structure of the work and the place and function of parts within the whole. There are, in the first book, for example, violent acts against women. We're not violent, but obscene and scatological. Uh-huh. Women are humiliated and debased.
So we shouldn't forgive him, but we should try to understand him.
Well, we should see what character is perpetrating these acts and for what purpose,
right,
and why within the larger design.
Now, you've told me that in your work on Rabelais and Duval, as you look at what you call the structure, the architecture of the texts here, that there really is a goal working. Even though these works appear to be episodic and unrelated and unstructured, Rabelais is taking us toward, he's using that sense of how things are not resolved. He's using that deliberately to teach us a lesson about Christian love. Mm-hmm. That's a big order, but unpack that for me.
Yes. I would say, first of all, that in the first two books, we have, in fact, contrary to appearances, a very linear, ordered narrative. Simply, our difficulty is that we are bred on novels, and our sense of linearity is a novelistic one.
And a beginning, a middle, and an end.
That's right. Well, Rabelais' books have beginning, middles, and ends as well, but we're less equipped to see them because we can only see the fragmented episodes, and we can't see the larger plot within which they are fitted, uh-huh, and adapted. And that larger plot is absolutely coherent, I've come to convince myself, and give some sense to each of the parts within it.
And what does it have to do with the theological notion of charity, caritas, Christian love?
Well, in the very first of these books, the Pantagruel, the epic design is what I call a messianic one, because the hero is placed in a position analogous to that of Christ within the scheme of redemption. But the original sin in this book is no longer the sin against God of pride, but it's a sin against brothers of fratricide. The story begins with Cain's murder of his brother Abel, and it ends with a kind of a reconciliation of brother to brother in a world of caritas.
Ned Duval, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. Your first book is on the design of Rabelais' Pantagruel. What have you been spending this year here at the Center doing?
I've been writing a sequel to this first book, which is about the sequel to Rabelais' first book, the so-called third book of Pantagruel, which is in fact just takes up the story where the Pantagruel leaves off with a pacified utopia in which there is no longer warfare and nothing can possibly happen. This book is one of the most learned, complex, and perplexing.
Again,
of all
this is hard work, huh?
Of Western literature. It's nominally about a quest. Panurge, the sidekick of the hero Pantagruel, wants to know whether he should get married or not. And he goes on an endless quest asking various consulting various sources of divination whether or not he should get married. Now, we never get an answer to this question, neither does Panurge.
Well, here we go back to this question of what's resolvable and what's unresolvable.
That's right. The book ends without a conclusion, and so we naturally think that it's either unfinished or it's unformed or there must be a sequel and so forth. And my work has been devoted to discovering the coherence of this book that's meant to stand as an autonomous whole. And to put it all in a nutshell, I would say that the forward-moving linear plot that leads us to believe there will be a revelation at the end is deliberately frustrated, and the book is constructed symmetrically in such a way as to highlight a much more interesting answer to this question at the center.
Ned Duval, I admire your scholarship and your patience working your way through this to modern readers is a very difficult kind of literature, Rabelais and Pantagruel and Gargantua. You are Edwin M. Duval. You're a professor of French at Yale University. Ned, have you had a good year at the Humanities Center?
I've had a wonderful year.
Well, it's been a pleasure to have you here, and I wish you well in your work.
Thank you, Wayne.
This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. In just a moment, I'll tell you where to write if you'd like a cassette tape of this week's show. My guests were Catherine O'Brien O'Keefe and Edwin Duval. Catherine O'Brien O'Keefe teaches at the University of Notre Dame. She's writing a book about sources, history, and interpretation in Old English literature. Edwin Duval is a professor of French at Yale University. He's at work on a multi-volume study of structure and design in the work of French writer François Rabelais. Send $5 for a cassette tape of this program or $2 for a Soundings catalog. Write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Ask for program number 673. That's program number 673, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. Next week, Improvised Europeans. Alex Zwerdling, a professor of English at the University of California at Berkeley, will be here to talk about American literary expatriates in 19th and 20th century Europe and America. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional funding from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Until next week at this time on this radio station, this is Wayne Pond. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.